ADWILL. I'm Jay Pearson for Celeste Quinn today. Our technical director is Jason Croft. Harriet Williamson helps put the show together. And in this hour, our topic is ambiguous loss. We'll be finding out about this concept, what it means to those of us who are impacted by it, and how we can handle it. And the author of the book, Ambiguous Loss, Learning to Live with Unresolved Grief, Pauline Boss, is our guest. She is a psychotherapist and a professor of family social science at the University of Minnesota and is past president of the National Council on Family Relations. And the book, Ambiguous Loss, Learning to Live with Unresolved Grief, is published by Harvard University Press and should be available at just about any bookstore that you might make a habit of visiting, or online, I would imagine, at the various online booksellers. And right now, let's welcome Pauline to the program. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Well, let's talk at the outset about the concept of ambiguous loss. Before I picked up this book earlier this week to prepare for the program, I had never really heard about it, but by the time I got done with it, I realized, and I imagine a lot of other people will be like me, that it affects me.
That's right. I've had an overwhelming response, and the book is already in its second printing, from people who say exactly that. In all the books on loss, you will not see the term ambiguous loss. So it's a term I coined. But it is a concept, it is a phenomenon that many of us have experienced. And oddly enough, in the arts, they write about it, but nobody ever gave it that name. Hmm. Missing people, people there but not there, and so on, all the way from Ulysses, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, the gist of what we're talking about is that we have certain losses in life of loved ones or family members through death, which is rather clear-cut. We have procedures in place for grieving and for dealing with this type of loss.
Yes, and we have rituals.
And rituals.
That is, people have support systems, and there are models to follow and mm-hmm. rituals in our various churches and synagogues to follow when death has occurred, which are designed to be helpful, in fact are helpful, for people to move through the grieving process. When you have an ambiguous loss, that is, if a person is physically missing in your life, or if a person is psychologically missing, such as from Alzheimer's disease, there's nothing there mm-hmm. for you. You're on your own. And even the professionals are not taught about this kind of loss, which often presents itself as depression or melancholia, unresolved grief, or frozen grief is what I call it.
Mm-hmm. And let me at this point give out the telephone numbers, because as the program goes along, if you would like to call in and join our conversation, the number in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455, and toll-free, it's 1-800-222-9455, and that number is good anywhere you can hear us. Again, in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL, or toll-free, anywhere, 1-800-222-WILL. Pauline Boss is my guest this afternoon. Ambiguous Loss, Learning to Live with Unresolved Grief is her book, and we're talking about the concept of ambiguous loss. And this really covers a wide range of losses, anywhere from, as you mentioned, a relative or a loved one with Alzheimer's who is psychologically absent but physically still present, all the way to divorce, where
yeah.
someone is psychologically present but physically absent.
That's right. Now, in my research over the last decades, I have always liked to begin with extreme samples, extreme situations. For example, my first research was with families of missing in action, mm-hmm. where the men were physically missing and the family didn't know if they were dead or alive. And then I did the other research where the body is there but the mind is missing with families of Alzheimer's disease. Both of those are extreme examples of ambiguous loss, but it's clear to me that in more everyday common examples, there is ambiguous loss, such as divorce, adoption, even when kids start leaving home for college or for a job. And sometimes many of us, just in our day-to-day, being absent because of work or being preoccupied at home with a work project and essentially driving our family crazy because we're there but not there.
Hmm. What is it that sparked your interest in this? What is it that that got you to start studying this and then led up to you coining the term ambiguous loss and writing this book and getting so deeply into this this heretofore really undefined area?
You know, that's a good question, and I had to ponder that quite a while after I was asked that the first time. I suspect it's because I grew up in the home of immigrants. My father came from Switzerland in the 1920s with the intention of going back and then hit the Depression and never had the money to go back, and then World War II and couldn't get back. The same happened to my maternal grandmother, who came even earlier. So, and then, of course, I grew up in a village called New Glarus, Wisconsin, where most of the people came from Switzerland or someplace else, so that this mourning, this chronic homesickness for people who were there but not there, never seeing their mother again, never seeing their siblings again, not being able to get back to their country of origin, that sort of melancholia was all around me. And I think from early on, I thought that homesickness was normal. And I call homesickness a kind of ambiguous loss. And today, with the new surge in immigration, though now not from Europe so much, but from other areas of the world, I'm seeing in my research the same phenomenon occurring when people can't get back again. If they can get back on a regular basis to their families of origin, to their homelands, this doesn't seem to be as much of a problem. Mm-hmm. But many people cannot go back for either political or financial reasons.
Now, speaking of the homesickness, you experienced this firsthand when you moved to Minnesota.
Yes, I did. I of course, grew up in New Glarus, Wisconsin, and then went to the University of Wisconsin, a wonderful university about 45 minutes north, and did all my degree work there and became a professor there. So I was still living in New Glarus, Wisconsin, actually in my mid-40s, when I had a job offer from the University of Minnesota. It was very, very hard to leave the village of my family and my childhood, and it was a rural setting, as you may guess. And suddenly, I was immersed in a large urban setting, the Twin Cities. And so I had a lot to learn about how one makes oneself at home in an urban setting, like locking your doors and not saying hello to everybody on the street. That seemed strange for someone of 45 years old, but it was a major uprooting, and I felt homesickness there, too. But I remember once getting a package in the mail. It was a shoebox wrapped in butcher cord and recycled wrapping paper, I could tell, from my mother. And she had sent me a shoebox full of potatoes that my father had grown. And she said, "Make some soup. You'll feel at home." And I found that just the most wonderful way of putting balm on ambiguous loss and homesickness. It did make me feel at home, and of course, I had the advantage of being able to go home as often as I chose to go, so my homesickness was short-lived. It was not like the homesickness of my father and grandmother, who never got back again. In the case of my father, he got back once just before his mother died, but there are many stories like that, and you hear them today, too, of people who pine for loved ones far away but can never get to them again. And that's what I call ambiguous loss.
You had a wonderful passage that just came to mind in the book about when you were home when your father was ill and when he passed away, and mm-hmm. you were at one point went home to what you described as your mother's tidy house.
I did.
And then you lay down under the Is it a quilt, a comforter?
A crocheted coverlet, yes. Yeah,
That your grandmother had knitted.
Yes. My grandmother was fortunate with her melancholia to run into a doctor in Monroe, Wisconsin, called Dr. John Schindler, who wrote, I think, a best-selling book some years in the 40s called How to Live Successfully 365 Days of the Year. He, too, was of Swiss origin and, I think, understood all these Swiss immigrants who had this same sort of malaise, pining for home, knowing they could never get back again. And he started groups for them at the Monroe Clinic in Monroe, Wisconsin. And for my grandmother, he recommended that she start needlework. And I found that a lovely prescription from a doctor that she needed a purpose in her life and she needed something that would connect her to her homeland in Glarus, Switzerland, where she had worked in the textile industry. And so knitting and crocheting was a way of connecting her to something she did as a youth in Switzerland. And I still have some of her lovely creations. And that quilt that I was sleeping under, or that coverlet that I was sleeping under while my father was in his failing days, was certainly a comfort. Mm. Some of these things, I believe, are connections that give families continuity over the generations. And I fear that today some of these things are not recognized as being healing, as being helpful. And in fact, I would go so far as to say necessary for family life and family continuity.
Mm-hmm. Our telephone numbers are 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Anywhere you can hear us if you'd like to join our conversation with Pauline Voss. Do you think that in these days when we have two parents out working and families are separated geographically a lot of times because of work and our days are so busy and so hectic we don't keep in touch with our families as much as perhaps we would like to or maybe used to?
I do think that, and I think it has nothing to do with whether or not you're living in the same house.
Mm-hmm.
I know families that I see in therapy, I'm not talking about research now, but in therapy who live in the same house, and for some reason, the bigger the house, the more likely the problem, where each person comes home after a hectic day and retreats to their own private room or their own private television set or headphones or computer. So that there's no more interaction in the family. They may share the same refrigerator, but not much else. And it's what I call a family with nobody in it.
Mm-hmm.
I worry about that.
And a lot of times, a family might not, or family members, you feel something isn't there, but you don't know exactly what it is. And as I was reading through your book, in a couple of different places, it seems like you're putting a finger on something that a lot of people feel. You just don't, you can sense something's not quite right, but you don't know exactly what it is. And in the case of families too, and this is where I felt it about my family, was spread all over the place: Florida, North Carolina, and Illinois.
Mm-hmm, and typical.
And that is pretty typical.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically my brothers and I now, but I realized that sometimes a year would go by and we wouldn't talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And while, I would feel a sense of, maybe I should pick up the phone and, give my brother a call or, maybe they should have called me. And there was kind of this uneasiness about why that had happened. I mean, after all, we're brothers. We grew up together, and it mm-hmm. seemed like there was this distance that was there. And I don't know, it's kind of a thing that still today is hard to deal with. Why is it that we're separated like this? Why is it that we don't get together on holidays?
I do believe in the psychological family. The concept of the psychological family is the underlying theme in this whole book. That doesn't go along with Talcott Parsons and many of the family values people who say you need a mother at home baking cookies and a father who's the breadwinner and children, and then you have a healthy family. I don't buy that as the one and true indicator of a good family. In fact, it's the minority of families today. What I think makes a good family is a family that's interacting together. And phone calls could do it, even emails can do it. And the wonderful, good old-fashioned idea of family reunions once a year, once every 5 years, can do it. There are various ways. I've seen cousins clubs being formed. And of course, the longest intimate relationship there is in the human condition is the sibling relationship. Mm-hmm. I say that because you mentioned your brothers. And it's a very important relationship that is longer than any other. So there are times in our lifetimes when they lie fallow. They're not very active. But my hunch is you'll start them up again.
Yeah.
And I would cheer that on.
Yeah.
Because I think I think family, the psychological interaction that goes on is very meaningful to human beings across the lifespan.
Mm-hmm. One of the things, and as you had mentioned, there are different ways of pointing out what we're talking about when we're discussing ambiguous loss and that concept. And one is to use extreme examples. And I understand a lot of your research came back, was conducted back during the Vietnam War.
The missing in action, it was.
With the folks missing in action, and then you talk about some of the Alzheimer's cases, and we can get to those.
That was more recent.
More recent, yeah. But you brought up one concept that was interesting, and we've been talking a little bit about the families and the value or non-value of what we consider to be the nuclear family these days. And one is in a divorce situation. This might hit home to a lot of folks, so maybe we can spend a moment talking about that. And in the book, you dealt with one woman, a family, and she was having a problem with setting, I guess the concept of even though there's a divorce, all of the people are still present, and there still needs to be some interaction, especially if, divorced parents are co-parenting and the like.
Yeah, I have the way I describe divorce is that it's never over.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I'm not talking now about the worst of the violent couples, where in fact those sometimes need to be over because of danger of life. But for the most part, I'm talking about divorces where the parents will continue to interact over the children. And that goes on across the lifespan. And so, as I tell in the book, my husband and I, even though we have been divorced for 17, 18 years now, we do co-host wedding dinners.
Mm-hmm.
We co-host baptismal dinners. We and our new spouses are together even at Thanksgiving and holiday dinners when our children are present and so on. Now, that may be not possible for everyone, but I think to some degree you have to realize that the marriage is a part of your life forever, even though you are divorced.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot erase what happened together, and especially if children were produced. And so there needs to be some civility.
Mm-hmm. And though the relationship is lost, there are other parts that do continue.
That's
and
right.
But we don't. Getting back to this, that in a clear separation, never going to see you again, never going to have a dealing with you again. We know the rules there. There's finality there, but in this. This relationship that the part of the marriage that continues even after the marriage itself is over, there aren't rules, and that's kind of
that's
what we're
right.
talking about. And we need to learn how to deal with this and set up some kind of a way to operate there.
And that's the hard part about divorce. Some people say it's even harder than if the spouse had died. To try and figure out how to do this for the exact reasons you mentioned.
Let's take a phone call from Taylorville on line 4. Good afternoon. You're on the air.
Yeah. I tend to be a broody, melancholy bastard, and I didn't get that way by choice. I really didn't. I had a haunted childhood. I caught this cartoon in the little Chicago paper years and years ago. This woman's telling her husband, "I'm leaving, and I'm taking the child with me." And it's called Free Associates by Matt Friedman. Not that, anyway. Her husband says, "No, you're not." And they tug with a little tug, and then they eventually they fight for the kid. Eventually, they fall on the floor, and he says to her, "You keep your half, I'll keep mine." Mm-hmm. I was torn apart in my soul the way those people as a kid.
That.
And I, speaking of loss, there's this woman I loved. She's still alive as far as I know. Black woman. Actually, she was brown in Gary. In the educational system, last I heard, she was a district supervisor.
Those are
and
all
I've been haunted. I've been haunted by this this thing every so often. I remember one afternoon I was thinking of her. I was in mid-step, and I started crying. I had one leg raised. This has been going on for years. Maybe there's something I can do about it, but I happen to be a guy. There are people. Do you know that Byron poem, "He Learned to Love Despair"? I think it's "The Prisoner," Sheldon. I'm one of them.
Yeah.
And
it sounds, breaking up with a loved one, is indeed an ambiguous loss. And, maybe you're doing one of the first things you need to do. In the book, I recognize that it needs to have a label, what it is you're experiencing. It's a loss, but it's not a loss because that person is still alive somewhere. You just don't know where they are. And some of the things that help regarding those kinds of situations are to talk about it more with people that are meaningful to you in your life and to find out what you've lost totally and what you still have. And in some cases, just the relationship you had with that person was a gift. And if you focus on what you still have for that person, you can internalize it in some way and then move on, even though you never get them back in the same way again.
Well, thank you very much for the call. And, I did notice, even just from reading your book, I recognized, and obviously I'm not a therapist, but I could recognize a lot of what he was saying. And, I guess what I'd say is that picking up this book and going through it gives you a lot of good information.
I'd like to say a bit about how the book was designed, and that is, I had the feeling that the public could handle a theory book on these unclear types of losses.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Harvard Press that agreed with me, though there were many publishing houses who rejected it, saying the public can't handle a theory book.
Huh.
And so I'm just delighted to hear from all these letters I'm getting that people are finding, whatever their own type of ambiguous loss is, that the book is useful to them. And that's the best kind of theory, useful theory.
The book is Ambiguous Loss, Learning to Live with Unresolved Grief, and Pauline Boss is a professor of family social science at the University of Minnesota and a psychotherapist in private practice and is also the past president of the National Council on Family Relations. And as you mentioned, it is published by the Harvard University Press and widely available. And our phone lines are open at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455 if you'd like to call in and maybe share an experience or ask a question as we go along. I'd like to talk about, since the caller that we had brought up the loss of a relationship and not knowing, and knowing that a person is still alive but not knowing where they are, this also ties in, I think, to cases of missing children, soldiers who are missing in action, and
earthquake victims,
right, and
terrorist victims, hostages.
Yeah, this is where the people physically aren't there, but psychologically are there, and there's no closure.
No closure. And so the family is more or less just frozen in place because they can't figure out if that person is coming back or not.
Mm-hmm.
And so they may cancel everything, cancel family life until that person returns. It's not the thing to do. The idea is to go on with your life, to celebrate the birthdays, to celebrate the Thanksgivings, the holidays, the religious events. Carry on, in spite of the fact that you don't know for sure if this person will ever again come back into your life.
How do you do that?
How do you do that?
Yeah.
Well, I recommend family meetings. That is, whoever your family is, whoever the people who are important to you are, get together and talk about this. Talk about the fact that you don't know for sure what's going on here. But then, nevertheless, at the same time, look forward and plan the next birthday or the next Thanksgiving and say, we're going to have this anyhow. I tell the story in the book of the family where the old father always sat at the head of the table and carved the turkey. This was a three-generational family, and it was a very important ritual. Mom brought out the old lace tablecloths and the best china and so on. And this last year, he botched the job. He couldn't get the turkey carved, and in fact, it was so bad, the turkey fell on the floor and stained the tablecloth and everything. The whole family was embarrassed, even though they had known he had been diagnosed with early Alzheimer's disease. And their decision was to cancel Thanksgiving next year, I think probably because of the embarrassment. When I saw them, I said to them, that's exactly the wrong thing to do. Why don't we sit here as a family together and brainstorm how to do Thanksgiving in a new way? In other words, how to adapt the ritual now to compensate for the illness.
Mm-hmm.
And they brainstormed several things. First of all, they said, well, we'll have Mom sit at the head of the table. Well, it was a patriarchal family, and that was not, according to their rules, it was not the thing to do, nor did Mom want to do that. Then they talked about the eldest son, and he said, no way, Dad's still living. I'm not going to sit at the head of the table. And finally, it was a child in the family who came up with the idea of, why doesn't someone carve the turkey in the kitchen and bring it in and set it in front of Grandpa, who can still sit at the head of the table in his chair? And that was just a superb idea, and it's so simple and yet so profound in its meaning.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the kind of thing we recommend for families. This is really prevention we're talking about. It's not high-level psychiatric prescription. This is a change in the family structure and function based on the fact that something is only partially absent or present in the family now.
Let's take another phone call. This one is, again, on line four, and it's from Aurora. Good afternoon.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon.
Hello.
In May, I lost my dog that I had had for 4 years, and the dog was a dog that I found and befriended me and really became a part of my life. I didn't choose the dog because I'm too busy these days with other family matters. But the dog fit in to my life very easily. It didn't have to be trained. You could tell the dog everything once. And it just fit in. She just fit in perfectly. She was a mixed breed terrier, and she very rapidly became a part of my life, in spite of the fact that I really didn't think I needed or wanted a dog.
Hmm.
Well, then in May of this year, 4 years later, she had an unfortunate accident and died. And, of course, I thought, what can I do now? You know, I have to do something. So I started to read books about dogs, and I read Stanley Korner's book, Why We Love the Dogs We Do, which was fascinating to read about, and I've shared it with my family members and other people, and said it just covered every area of owning a dog, and it was very, very good reading. And then I read some parts of his The Intelligence of Dogs. And then I read a book of dog stories where the proceeds from the sale of the book went to Lollipop Farms, a place for dogs, the stray dogs up in Rochester, New York. So I began to find out about what other people are doing about dogs from my own house, you know, and from my own reading.
Very good.
And then I read Naming Our Dogs and Our Cats, which was just a delightful book to read about naming dogs and cats. And I found out that Richard Simmons named his dogs and cats after the characters in Gone with the Wind, and I thought that was such a novel idea. So he had a Prissy and an Aunt Pitty Pat and a Scarlet and a Red Butler, and it sounded so cute. And then this week, I read James Harriet's Cat Stories and Dog Stories. Mm-hmm. And doing all this has helped.
Yes, it sounds like you're making meaning out of this loss of really what was a family member for you by becoming an expert on dog stories. People do this in very creative ways, and I think you are doing it in a creative way by reading all that you can, the literature on dogs, and you're going to become an expert, by the way, on it. And that's a good way to do it. It's a way to make meaning out of the loss, and one can say out of having had this wonderful companion in your life.
Of course, the fact that you lose a dog, it told in the book Why We Love the Dogs We Do, about how some people would, if they had a dachshund, would buy, and it died, they'd buy another dachshund and name it Max, the same name as the other. So they then, in fact, had the same dog.
We call that first-order change, yeah.
And
that's just substituting, isn't it?
And so it was interesting to see what and how other people deal with this grief, mm-hmm. that you can't bring the dog back. So I have decided on this one book of dog stories that I read. I can't remember the exact title, but the monies went to this, as I said, this Lollipop Farm mm-hmm, mm-hmm. in Rochester, New York. And I thought I'm going to give that book to the dog lovers among my friends and family. And then with the money going to that farm, that would be one way of resolving some of this grief.
What you've done is a wonderful way to make a loss of something more meaningful to you. And a lot of people do that with the loss of human family members as well, where they begin working for a foundation, or they start a foundation, or they change a law, or they do something about it. They become active. Years ago, when we lost my brother to polio, during the polio years, our family made the March of Dimes our major charity for a long time, and it made us feel good. It made some sense out of a terrible loss. It sounds like you're doing just that. I cheer you on. Good job.
And thank you very much for calling and sharing your experience with us. 333-9455 and 1-800-222-9455 are our numbers, and we do have time for a few more calls. For Pauline Boss, let's talk a little about how addiction can also lead to an ambiguous loss. That's a situation where a person may be, there sometimes and sometimes not, both physically and psychologically.
That's right. Addiction is a big area of ambiguous loss. I have not done research myself in this area, so I can only talk about it clinically, mm-hmm. but I think it's a very, very difficult thing for the remaining family members to have somebody there fully physically and psychologically, and then all of a sudden they're high on drugs or they're drunk from alcohol, and essentially they're there but not there.
Or they're there in a different state, a different way.
They're in a different
behaving,
they're in an altered state. And so the family is totally thrown into not knowing how to act. Frequently family members will say, we walk on eggs when dad's home, when mom's drunk. That's the wording that family members use. We have to walk on eggs. was a very, very stressful, distressful thing for families to have to go through. And what they need to know is the person going to be with them or not with them? And it's almost easier if they're going to be that way that they not come home at all.
Let's hold the thought on that because something else occurred to me, but we do have another caller on line one from Champaign, and we welcome you to the air this afternoon.
Thank you. I have an ambiguous loss within my family. My oldest child is divorcing the spouse, and the spouse and I have been very close for a number of years, and they live within the same area where we are and have children and so forth. And I thought your comments about civility through divorce were very important. And I talked to both of these people about how very important that is for the children's sake.
Absolutely.
As well as everyone else. But my problem is holidays. It's very difficult. How do you handle a holiday when they're lots of family members within the area, and you usually always all got together.
Yeah, right, it's right the holidays, isn't it, that
mm-hmm.
really bring
yeah,
up
terrible.
The stress.
And right now I'm having, like, two Christmas dinners and, you know, that sort of thing. It gets very difficult.
Well, I can only brainstorm because I don't know your case per se, but your question is a really good one. And I would say if the divorce is recent, things are pretty raw.
Mm-hmm.
So what you might do this year and next year might be different than what you do 5 years from now.
Okay.
So I'd encourage you to have family meetings every year about how can we do it,
mm-hmm.
So that it meets your needs and the needs of other people. And especially for the benefit of the children, in the best interest of the children, seems to me to be the guiding mantra for all of us.
Right.
We are, after all, supposed to be grown-ups and civil, and we should keep the best interests of the children in mind. And sometimes that'll end up meaning two holiday dinners.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe a few years down the road, it might not mean that. It might mean one.
I hope so.
Uh-huh.
Well, they're our cousins within this family group, too. So, you know, it really makes it divided when we have two separate occasions. And some are invited, I mean, two of the children are invited to two dinners, and two are invited to one, and it just gets very complicated.
Yeah, and it could, in fact, make for rifts even because of the dinners.
Yes. I'm hoping...
I don't know if you're familiar with what family therapy is, but family therapists work with that kind of thing also.
Mm-hmm.
It's a prevention thing. It's a way of preventing further family trouble after a divorce. And it would not be an unusual request for a family therapist, and you have many good ones in the Chicago area, in the Urbana area,
mm-hmm.
Champaign-Urbana area, that could work with you. Just a couple sessions might do it,
mm-hmm.
On getting everybody together, and you'd have a facilitator there who would be the family therapist,
mm-hmm.
who could say, this is a family that would like to have some interaction together in spite of the divorce,
mm-hmm.
and let's see if we can figure out a way to do this.
Well, I'm hoping that, as you say, the future may bring enough civility so that we can at least have a holiday together, more for the children's sake than anyone else's. So
yes.
I'll work toward that.
Yes, and the fact that you were friends with the your child's mm-hmm. ex-spouse makes you in a precarious position,
mm-hmm.
because, of course, you want to be loyal to your your own child,
yes.
but you also shouldn't have to sacrifice the friendship.
Well,
so in that regard,
I've made it clear that I'm not going to.
Yeah.
But
and
that,
certainly your grandchildren.
Yeah. Oh, definitely
sacrifice.
Not. No, there's no problem with that.
Yeah.
So, well,
good luck to you. There's another book called The Good Divorce by Constance Ahrens.
Hmm.
Let's see. HarperCollins, I think,
okay.
in any bookstore. That is about divorce and how people can make it work.
Okay.
Divorce does not have to mean a broken family.
Mm-hmm.
Divorce can mean a restructured family.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. I'm writing that down, and I will go buy it. Thank
Great.
You.
Thank you very much for the call, too. And we have just a few minutes left with Pauline Boss, the author of Ambiguous Loss, Learning to Live with Unresolved Grief. And I thought in the last few moments, you know, we've been talking a lot about, you've been talking a lot about family meetings, about talking about things. And I think what happens in a lot of situations, when something happens, a family member develops Alzheimer's, there may be some embarrassment, there probably is a lot of denial. Addiction would be the same way. There's a lot of uncertainty and unknown in having someone missing and the like. But you keep coming back to family meetings, talking about these things, deciding together, not pushing this aside. And it, in the case of an Alzheimer's patient who might be a family member, a grandparent, I mean, they're still physically there. They're still a part of the family, and I guess the tendency, you know, in a lot of cases tends to be, you know, almost writing their death sentence, almost, you know, like, well, they're not a functioning member of the family anymore.
Well, that's that age-old American idea that if you're not productive, you're not worth anything. Mm-hmm. Well, that made our country great. We've got to change our mind about that when we have incurable illnesses. And Alzheimer's is one. And just because somebody isn't as productive as they used to be doesn't mean we have to pretend they're not there anymore or close them out of our family prematurely. But that takes a different view of the world, and that's what I'm encouraging. And frequently, the reason I say family meetings as opposed to one person going to see a psychotherapist about this, the family meeting frequently involves some younger people who, by the way, are more creative. And they'll come up with, I think, often wonderful ideas for how to do something in a different way. And that's why I call it family meetings instead of family therapy. The family is not sick. The family is dealing with a situation that is troublesome and sometimes even pathological. So what we're trying to do is figure out how can this family, now distressed with this ambiguous loss, figure out a way to move forward in spite of it. And that's why I call them family meetings. Some families can do this on their own, sit around the table and have this discussion. Other families need a coach, a family therapist, to facilitate that, and then later on carry it on themselves. And of course, then there are families that are deeply troubled who need help doing that all the way. Mm-hmm. But for those of us who can do it at home around our own kitchen table, call up the relatives and say, we're going to have a family meeting about this. I'd say, go for it. You'll be surprised how much can be helped in a family that is living with some kind of ambiguous loss if you just talk together and make some decisions how to move forward in spite of it.
Mm-hmm. And the book is Ambiguous Loss, Learning to Live with Unresolved Grief. It's put out by the Harvard Press, widely available. And we'll answer a lot more questions that we just don't have time to now because we're out of time. But Pauline, I'd like to thank you very much for being with us this hour and talking with our callers.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you again. Pauline Boss is the author of the book Ambiguous Loss, Learning to Live with Unresolved Grief. She is a professor of family social science at University of Minnesota and a psychotherapist in private practice and a past president of the National Council on Family Relations. She coined the term ambiguous loss.